Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So could you tell me your title here?
Yeah, my name is Harvey Smith, and my title at Arcane Studios is Game Director. And on the project that we're working on specifically right now, I'm the lead designer.
Lead designer. What does Game Director mean?
Well, it basically means that sometimes we have multiple projects and we look for a specific director of the project.
Uh-huh.
And then if we have one, we might do the thing where, like, one of our game directors just serves as lead designer on it or something. So for a while we were working on two projects, but right now we're working on something super exciting that we all want to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm on that project as lead designer, even though my company title is game director.
Okay. What kind of education did you have, or what kind of background do you have to have this kind of job?
I think while that's really important now, like if I was advising someone going in, I would tell them to go to Carnegie Mellon or someplace like that.
In computer and computer science? Or
well, it depends on what their discipline is. Like, mm-hmm. you know, some of my friends have gone to the Entertainment Technology Center at Carnegie Mellon, and
mm-hmm.
people come out of there as game designers, game play programmers, or even some people go off to Disney and design theme park rides or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, again, it's entertainment technology.
Mm-hmm.
I've had other friends come out of schools like Full Sail
mm-hmm.
or Guildhall. I think that stuff is awesome, interning or going to school or whatever now.
Uh-huh.
But when I, 15 years ago, almost 16 years ago, I was a lit major and I mm-hmm. dropped out and moved to Austin and went to work at a game company. So I didn't even finish a degree, actually.
Right.
And at our company at the time, one of my friends, a brilliant guy named Zach Simpson, who's a molecular biology guy for
mm-hmm.
UT, I could be mistaken, but I don't think he finished high school. And he was our tech director at Origin, and he was
uh-huh.
he's just super smart and, like, deeply into entertainment technology. He's an artist also. He makes
mm-hmm.
projector-based art projects, installations.
Interesting. What's his name?
Zach Simpson.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at the time it was more about, you know, I felt qualified for my job
mm-hmm.
At the time because I had experience leading small teams.
Mm-hmm.
I was just coming out of the Air Force. And I was a writer. I had sold a short story and had been writing, had a lot of
mm-hmm.
unpublished material that I had done, so I at least was familiar with writing at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a super hardcore video game player for many, many years since the advent of video games, of course.
Right.
And as a result of those combinations of things, I could talk about games, break them down,
mm-hmm.
I understood what worked and what didn't work, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I could motivate people to move them in one direction or another. And that's the kind of job that I got early on at Origin in 93.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. There was no school that I think at the time.
That would do that.
I mean, maybe MIT, of
mm-hmm.
course. They had. I worked with some people from MIT, and they didn't come out of it so much ready to make a video game, to lead video game projects or anything like that, or to shape them in terms of the emotional experience or anything, but they
mm-hmm.
came out of them very well prepared for the game design mechanical side and the technology side. You know?
Right.
So they were definitely ahead of everybody else.
Yeah.
MIT.
Did you stay at Origin? Do game developers tend to stay at one place for a long time, or?
Well, in my case, I stayed at Origin for I think 3.5 years or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and I had a project canceled. And I was very, very disappointed by that, and I saw most of my teammates fired,
hmm.
And I made some mistakes that. Where I could have done something else and kept it alive, so I take the blame for that. But at the same time, there were a lot of projects being killed at Origin at that time, because EA had taken over the company a couple of years before that,
mm-hmm.
and was really getting serious about trying to make the company profitable, you know. And Origin, I think, in the past had been more about doing something interesting and innovative and new. And so, you know, naturally those are two forces in business that have to coexist.
Right.
And it was a, I was not yet, I had not learned enough, I was not mature enough about it, and so I left the company after my project got canceled.
Right.
You know, and it's one of those things, like, I have few regrets, but it's like one of those moments when, like, I could have done one thing and kept the game alive, and who knows how that would have come out and how that would have shaped the rest of my career or whatever. But but anyway, I left and I moved to California. I went to San Mateo and I went to a startup called Multitude, and I worked on a game called Fireteam, which was like the first game with voice.
It
came with a little headset. And that was like a super great learning experience, just like Origin had been. But I stayed at, if you covered my entire history, I stayed at Origin for three and a half years. I stayed at Multitude for a year and a half while we shipped one game. I then went to Ion Storm where we made Deus Ex, and I stayed there for 6 years. And then I was a contractor independently consulting with people for 8 months. And then I went to Midway for 3 years. And then I came to Arcane, and I've been here for a year and a half.
Right.
And so 6 years and 3 years, those are, you know, the average for me, I guess.
Right. It's a pretty long time.
I see it in terms of projects, you know. I would stay at a company for one or two projects, probably.
Right. So when you guys are working on a game, and we can talk about the current game that you're working on, or we can talk about the last game. It, it doesn't really matter to me. How do you come up with the idea? Does somebody give you the idea and you work on it, or do you just sort of come up with your own game idea and then try and sell it to somebody else?
Yeah, so I guess by idea you mean like the it's so funny because it's hard, it's a, actually a pretty hard question to answer because you know, a game is a thousand ideas. There's generally what people outside of games see as the idea, which is like, you know, you're a spy during the Cold War, but the Russians have done something that creates zombies, and so, you know, I mean, that's a fictional idea. That's an idea for a story.
Right.
Then there's like, hey, if we use the rendering technology that we use to create a 3D space, we could create a plane in front of the player that isn't the space actually contiguously in front of him, but it's the space from some other part of the 3D environment, so if he walks through this plane, he appears in some other spot. Oh, let's make a game about teleportation mechanics.
Right.
And so that's an idea. You know, and that's a gameplay idea. And then there are people working on what the character looks like and what the world setting is, and somebody else is like, oh my god, I just had an idea for a recorder system where we record every single input from the player and from an AI, and we record every single like physics change in the world. So at any point you could back up, rewind it like a VCR, 6 seconds, and then proceed from that point forward again. Maybe the outcome would be different this time. Then you could back up again, and so you know, that's just a technology idea that that is really exciting that someone turned into. People have turned into different games over time. So. So where does the idea come from? It's, you know, it's like, it depends on what you're talking about. Like, there's also people that work sort of in genres. Like, okay, over time, genres have emerged. So moving around in the world from first-person perspective in a very fast-paced environment with guns, that's the shooter genre, right? And so sometimes when you work on a shooter, the gameplay ideas are lower level. They're like, they're all the conventions of the genre.
Yeah, right.
You know,
shoot things.
You shoot things and run and jump. And then at a lower level, somebody might be like, ooh, here's a neat idea for how to reload the weapon and turn that into a mini game. If you do it right, it reloads it with more shots. If you do it poorly, it reloads it with fewer shots. Oh, that's active reloading. They tried that in Gears of War. It was like a small idea, but it was a new idea, right? And so that's, you know, that's a tiny low-level idea, I guess, but...
Well, okay, so how do these ideas get communicated to everybody on the team, and then you, I guess, would decide to incorporate them into the entity.
what we do is like, you know, we talk to whoever's funding the game,
uh-huh.
and they might have a strong opinion or they might not.
Mm-hmm.
They might say, look, we've got this intellectual property, we've got
mm-hmm.
SpongeBob SquarePants,
right.
or we've got Star Wars, or we've got whatever,
mm-hmm.
Tonka Trucks, whatever it is, we need you to do something in that space.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes the idea comes from that. It's very constrained.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Other times they don't have an intellectual property to work with, but they're going to create a new one. And they say, hey, our research shows that there are about 12 aspirational fantasies that the typical gamer wants,
mm-hmm.
that he's excited about.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is race car driver, one's fighter pilot. I mean, it's simple adolescent power
uh-huh.
fantasy type stuff.
Uh-huh.
Is there anything interesting you could do with one of those that clearly communicates that it is, in fact, one of those?
Right.
So sometimes that happens. But in any case, we end up with this amalgam of, you know, the intellectual property that we either want to work on or are creating or have to work on,
mm-hmm.
and the gameplay ideas that we want to experiment with, that
mm-hmm.
we're excited about, that people have come up with, and everybody's excited or not excited. You know, we determine that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the genre conventions, the expectations from players about this type of game, if there are any. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
you're not working in a genre. You know, Fireteam was like, I don't think there was a genre that we were working in at all. It was a real-time, multiplayer-only, team-based game with voice that was
mm-hmm.
very sports-like. So
mm-hmm.
at the time, the internet was a new platform
right.
for gaming, and so there were fewer expectations in terms of dogma. But anyway, we start with a small group of people discussing it, trying to decide what we're excited about, what fits into the game
mm-hmm.
thematically and cohesively, what we actually have production time and resources to create,
mm-hmm.
what we know how to implement, how many risks we're taking,
mm-hmm.
and we go through a big process like that where all of those different axes are used to determine whether an idea goes into a game or not,
mm-hmm.
whether we pursue that. And then we farm it out to different people on the team. Sometimes they up-channel their ideas. Hey, I went and did research on this one thing, and I thought about it for a while, and
mm-hmm.
here's the system I've planned.
Mm-hmm.
Or here's the fictional idea I've got, or here's the idea for a mission that I've got. We were just talking
mm-hmm.
mission ideas right when you walked in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at this point, most things I've seen before in some form or another. And it's really all about the execution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the two of the games I was alluding to earlier, Portal and Braid, are two of my favorite games of all time, I think. And
mm-hmm.
the people that made them, I think, are brilliant and dedicated. But the notion of a teleportation tool in a game
mm-hmm.
and the notion of a time travel recorder function in a game,
mm-hmm.
those have both been discussed over and over. Those have both even appeared in games prior. It's
mm-hmm.
just that the execution
mm-hmm.
in Portal and Braid, and specifically the attention to the player's emotional experience going
mm-hmm.
through both of those games, was so profound and so powerful that those games stand out as like
mm-hmm.
two of the best games ever, I think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So really it's so much less about the idea and more about the execution of the idea, you know. I think
so
that's
how
true.
Do you manage that whole process of do you have paperwork? I mean, do you have documents that set out who's doing what and what the big idea is, or
yeah.
all of the ideas put together?
Yeah, right now, I guess, on our core team, there's less than 10 people working on
mm-hmm.
the game that we're working on, probably.
Uh-huh.
And some of those people, one of them came to my desk earlier, and he's been sketching out a map on paper
mm-hmm.
because we gave him the constraints. It has to do these 8 things. And some of those things are mechanical, and some of those things are fictional,
mm-hmm.
And some of those things are tonal. And
so, give me an example. Tonal, like it needs to be sad.
Yeah,
or
like this is a game about. Let's imagine for a second. This is not the game we're working on, but let's imagine that we're talking about a game about a woman who's had a dream that her fiancé would be shot at a birthday party she's throwing for him in 1 month.
Uh-huh.
And she has to go through her daily life for the next month and at these key moments turn left when she would have turned right and try to build a new future that, that does not involve him being shot.
Uh-huh.
It's the sort of butterfly flaps its wings
mm-hmm.
type thing. Obviously, in that kind of, if that was the game you were working on, there would be certain types of music, certain types of lighting
right.
styles, certain types of characters, certain situations, a certain pace
mm-hmm.
that would be appropriate or not appropriate from a creative direction standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And tone is one of those things. It's very important.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
So anyway, somebody came earlier with a sketch, and meanwhile we were talking, Raph and I were just talking about a mission idea. And at the same time, almost overlapping with that, with our guy in Montreal over video conference, we were talking about how we want to handle difficulty levels. Like, there's
mm-hmm.
three difficulty levels in the game. And we don't want to just make the monsters harder to fight or whatever. We want
right.
to actually
yeah.
change the objectives for the player, make them more interesting.
Uh-huh.
And so, we at this point, we have a document called the GDD.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we call game design document, sometimes
mm-hmm.
we call it the goddamn document. And some other guys are working on the TDD, the technical design doc.
Mm-hmm.
That's the programmers in the back of the room. And so when they hear us say, we need to be able to save the game state at
mm-hmm.
any time.
Right.
And then they go, oh my god, how are we going to do that? Because we were licensing middleware, this engine technology.
Mm-hmm.
It does this very well. If all you want to save is, like, where the player's at.
Right.
And whether the monsters are dead or not. But
mm-hmm.
if it wants to save, like, I set a box on a staircase and it starts tumbling down,
mm-hmm.
and then I save the game at that point halfway through this physical,
mm-hmm.
this physics interaction with the object in the staircase, saving the state for the box, and saving the guard awareness or whatever, like whether the cop saw you or not saw you, or
right, yeah.
whether this
mm-hmm.
window behind you is broken, and whether I left a Coke can on the bookshelf. Like
mm-hmm.
every little thing you save, the particular middleware that we're dealing with struggles with that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So they're back there going, oh my god, how are we going to support the game design features technically?
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, we're in the game, the GDD, we're going through and we're saying, oh my god, how do we want to handle dropping items. If you're holding an item and you're using it and it's in your inventory or in,
mm-hmm.
and then you drop it, like, because there's infinite ways you can do everything
mm-hmm.
And they all come with problems and strengths, you know, so we might say, oh well, once you pick up an item of this type, like let's say this was a painting game
mm-hmm.
and you found a paintbrush in the trainer at the beginning of the game.
Mm-hmm.
We might say, you can never drop the paintbrush.
Mm-hmm.
We always want to assume in the game that when you hit this button on the controller, the paintbrush comes out and you're ready to
mm-hmm.
go.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could throw the paintbrush off of a bridge,
mm-hmm.
now you might not be able to get out of the mission, if the mission
right,
goal
yeah,
required
right.
you to paint something. So,
mm-hmm.
but then somebody else goes, well, we want to be able to upgrade the paintbrush over time, or we want to be able to give you the choice of paintbrush. Maybe you prefer a really long one or a really spongy, sloppy
mm-hmm.
one or whatever. And so then we're like, okay, well, the system will let you pick up a new one, and you can transfer it into your hand,
mm-hmm.
switching them in and out, and you can drop the one that's in your backpack, but you've always got to have one in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
So if you pick one up at the beginning of the game, it's forever in your hand. If you pick up an alternate one, you can move it into the hand, and it moves the other one into the backpack, and then
mm-hmm.
you can throw that one away, but you always have to have one in your hand
uh-huh.
from the first minute of the game forward. And that's just like one tiny little system out of
mm-hmm.
thousands
right.
that has to be bulletproofed against the player screwing himself, and also has to be plumbed for all the like most exciting ideas about how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the games we work on are very broad,
mm-hmm.
and so we're constantly trying to go deep and trying to go broad at the same time, and
right.
that's obviously a conflict.
Yeah.
And so then we end up doing things where we're like, look, in 90% of these features, we're going to do the minimum expected level for the genre or for the type of game it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then for 10 or 20% of them, we are going to really try to do something new and special, you
mm-hmm.
know.
And so all of those decisions decisions that you were talking about would go into the game design document?
They generally get discussed.
Mm-hmm.
They get plotted out on a whiteboard or on paper. They
mm-hmm.
get traded back and forth between, you know, two or three or four of us that are, like, making the final decisions before we part of the big team.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they're sort of codified, you know, once they're decided this is the way we're going, we put them in the GDD.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a meeting this morning to cut some pending ideas. We had a pending section.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through and we said, okay, last week we added this to the pending. It seemed like an exciting idea. Do we want to pursue it or not? You know, and yes, we want to pursue that one. How would it work? Okay, let's detail it out. Okay, we're going to pursue it, and this is how it works. Let's move it into the document somewhere. Now, this next pending idea, what about that? No, it's a big pain in the ass. We thought we might want to support that, but come to think of it, we're just doing too much. Let's just cut that. And it cuts three support systems, and now we have time to go deep on the other things that we've got. And so we just have these...
And so are these pending ideas in the document, or are they on a whiteboard?
They're in the document, okay. At the bottom of the whiteboard, the bottom of the document.
Uh-huh. And then, so does the game design document ever get finished? Is there ever a point at which it is done?
Ours is like 65 pages right now, and we keep adding to it and taking from it, and but really what you want to happen is projects happen in phases, like four or five phases, and we're in pre-production right now, so we're planning and deciding, but at a certain point we will move into prototyping, and then like how the, like that example I gave earlier about the paintbrush and the inventory, at a certain point we'll have that prototype, so you will, it won't be pretty yet, it won't have the final art, but it will be like, you can pick something up and use it and move it around in your inventory, etc. And so, at some point, the document becomes irrelevant. Because even if we weren't sure how it was going to go, it becomes faster just to play around with the actual code itself, or the editor, or the artwork that, that is in the game. And look at it in the game and get a feel for it in the game. And then sometimes new ideas come that were never in the GDD to begin with. So in the later phase, like vertical slice, you know, moving up toward production, the GDD is less important. It's a repository for ideas, for why we wanted to do things, for the philosophy of why we wanted to do them. But as they get moved into the game one at a time, and or cut, the GDD becomes less relevant, and the game itself is the document. It's like a living document.
So... do people refer back to the GDD when they're making, when they're programming and stuff?
Sometimes, because what happens is a programmer will go to the section of the GDD called inventory and manipulating objects in your hand, you know, whatever. And from that, he and the designers will derive a programming spec, which is just like a series of functional bullet points, like... when the player does this, this happens. The player's feedback for this is displayed here. And then he'll go right from... it goes from game design document to functional spec to in the game. And then people evaluate it in the game and they make tweaks there.
Okay. And can you tell me a little bit about the technical design document and how that differs from the game design document?
Yeah, so basically what they do is they look at the game design document and they break everything up into modules, like movement through the world is probably its own module. You know, swimming might be a form of movement that might be its own module. Picking up objects and dropping objects, manipulating objects is probably its own module. And so they break it up according to implementation, how it's going to be implemented. And then they... you know, they often describe different strategies for doing things. Like, there are many different ways to store data about objects. Like, if I walk into an environment and I strike a crate once with a crowbar, and I put a mark on the crate, like it looks cracked, and I know if I hit it three more times, it might break and then fall to smaller pieces. But then if I leave and I come back an hour later... and I look at that crate. Some games don't record the data around the crate. They remember the position of the crate, and they remember what art it has on it, and they know on the fly what the lighting calculation is on it, which sides are dark or whatever. But they might not go as far as remembering that it's been struck once. Other games do. It's important to the game that like they cohesively remember every action of the player. And so the programmers have to decide, how do we store that data? Like... does it live in the object itself? Does it, you know? So I'm not an engineer, but you know, they, there are many different strategies for all of these things, like how lighting is calculated, and they might look at it and they say, look, here's what we know the player wants. The player wants an environment with some atmospheric lighting mm-hmm. that allows him to see, but also has pools of darkness that he can use strategically, or he can turn on a light to distract someone, or turn off a light so that the cop can't see him, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that some of the lights in the world need to be just for atmospherics, mm-hmm. colored lights or whatever, and they need to be very accessible to the artists. And some of the lights in the world need to be dynamic. They need to be, you can turn them on and off, and they need to be attached to an object
mm-hmm.
so the player can shoot out the lights or whatever. And some of them need to cast shadows, and some of them don't need to cast shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's our hierarchy for, here's our structure for how we're going to do that. We're going to have this many types of lights. Here's where they're going to be controlled from. You know, here's which one, which types cast shadows and which types don't cast shadows. I mean,
mm-hmm.
basically, like, they know that if we made every single light in the world dynamic
mm-hmm.
right. and casting shadows, then the game would run too slow. So they have to come up with a
right.
A structure to meet all the needs of this player experience. And you know, so they're working on, they're taking the design doc and breaking it down into modules and deciding how, as engineers, they're going to support each one of those modules.
Mm-hmm. And is there a person in charge of sort of overseeing both the GDD and the TDD?
Yeah, typically, like on our team, there's a project director.
Mm-hmm.
And that person is ultimately responsible for everything that goes into the game. That's the idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether you call it producer or whatever.
Right.
But really, the TDD is owned by the lead engineer.
Right.
Like, typically, no one's going to go against what the lead engineer says.
Right.
We might tell him the needs, like, hey, this is really what we need. If he's good, he's not dictating stuff. He's asking.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, what's the priority here? Is it more important that you have many, many dynamic lights in the level, or is it more important that, you know, you have this other thing? It's a trade-off. Which one do you want?
Right.
And he's also implemented these things many different ways, and he knows what the trade-offs are, and
mm-hmm.
You know, he will say things like, we could do it that way. We could make every light in the level dynamic and shadow casting.
Mm-hmm.
But that tends to be super slow, and you tend to not need it on many of the lights anyway,
mm-hmm.
the ones that are for atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So what if instead we did it this way, you know? And
mm-hmm.
we look at it from a gameplay standpoint, and as lead designer, I might say, yeah, I don't think that's important. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the project director tends to, like, make the final vote, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
okay, I see your point, but this is the way we're going to go.
Right. In day-to-day operations, how are the leaders communicating what needs to be done to the programmers and designers and stuff?
Typically, we have a producer who is in service to the little cabal that kind of like directs the game or decides what the game is about and
mm-hmm.
how we're going to do this and how we're going to do that and what we're going to support and what features we're not going to support. That group works closely with the producer who
mm-hmm.
typically drives the day-to-day task of the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them, it sets up how long it's going to take for each task, who's going to help them with this, what order they need to do these things in, because
mm-hmm.
somebody's waiting on this one dependent. You know,
mm-hmm.
we're checking dependencies here.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when they're going to roll onto the project and off the project, because most people aren't on the project the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
Most people might be, like, allocated to another project that makes money, a contract job or something.
Right.
And so we need them, and then they're rolled onto the project for 8 months or for a year or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and then they roll off the project. So that there are fewer cooks in the kitchen at some point.
Right.
And so really, there are many different strategies for how people get their tasks, but
mm-hmm.
Here there's a producer that's responsible for that, and we use a kind of a whiteboard system where some software that looks like a whiteboard with sticky notes on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have 6-week sprints,
mm-hmm.
And people will like, tasks are not grouped. The old way to schedule is kind of bad. There's just a long list of tasks and people jump on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the new way is, the thinking that people have taken in the last few years is, this month's milestone or this work what does it add up to that the player sees on the screen?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it might not be called Milestone 1 with these 100 tasks. Instead, it might be the player riding a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And that might imply the same 100 tasks.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it might imply just as many tasks, 100.
Mm-hmm.
It might take just as much time as Milestone 1, but, like, they're divided differently. They're organized. The 100 tasks that we choose are the ones that have to add up to the player getting on a horse,
mm-hmm.
dismounting, getting thrown from the horse, the speed at which he rides, turning the horse, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in terms of scheduling and tasks, that's how it works.
Okay. So you were talking about three different phases of production. Do they have names? Four or five, actually, is what you said.
Yeah, every studio divides it up differently,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, really, like, for the project we're on now, we had a phase that I would call business development,
mm-hmm.
where we were going around talking to people saying, hey, this is specifically the kind of game we make.
Mm-hmm.
It's first-person perspective. It's very immersive. Sometimes there are role-playing game elements. Sometimes there are shooter elements mixed in a hybrid. It's very cohesive. It's a little slower pace. It's very atmospheric. And there's a couple of other elements. Like, the environment itself is... it's very grounded. It feels like people live here. Like,
mm-hmm.
And further, there's a very analog artificial intelligence that where enemies don't just instantly know where you're at. They have to see you according to the light and distance
mm-hmm.
and sound you make, and that provides a lot of gameplay. And so during the business development phase, we went around and talked to different partners potentially about who might want to work on this type of game with us.
Mm-hmm.
And then once that was underway, we're in a pre-production phase where we're deciding what the game is and how we're going to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a certain point we say, okay, we know enough. Now we're moving toward vertical slice.
Okay, so how do you decide that you know enough? Do you send it to the partner?
No, we look
so
at it
yeah.
and we say, I mean, they check. They have their own process on the publisher side where
uh-huh.
they're checking things constantly anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But we just look at it and we say, what is this game?
Mm-hmm.
And we figure out everything you need to do to meet the genre expectations and to go deeper on some other areas. And
mm-hmm.
So let's say we decide that this game involves, I don't know how many modules it involves, but like let's decide that there, you need a structure for, you need a delivery means by which to give the player missions, and the player needs environments to go into to undertake these missions that will be 12 or 20 hours of gameplay or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
and you need X number of tools in the game to manipulate
mm-hmm.
the AI
okay.
to do whatever. We just go over that until we think the game is complete.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut a few things because we talk to the producer and he's like, wow, there's not enough man hours
mm-hmm.
across our team to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to some point where we're happy just kind of intuitively
mm-hmm.
checking it against other games and what type of game it is. And, a pretty common mistake coming into the game in this industry is failing to think in terms of like high wedges,
mm-hmm.
or in terms of finite resources, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And like we routinely hear from like inexperienced people, or we even got this pitch from a publisher one time, not the game we're working on now, obviously, but where some junior guy at the company on the publishing side had written this document where they said they really liked Call of Duty, and they thought Call of Duty had great multiplayer unlockables, and they really wanted to use that. They wanted that system. But then he said, however, it didn't have very deep physics in terms of the mission gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
This other game had fantastic physics in the mission. So we want the unlockables from multiplayer in Call of Duty
mm-hmm.
and the physics from this game. But this other game didn't have very good lighting, so we want the lighting from this game.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically cherry-picked from all the games in the industry, the top games,
mm-hmm.
and chose the, like, 10 or 12 features that were the best thing in every single game.
Right.
And it's like, you just feel like taking this young person with no experience and saying, or maybe it wasn't a young person,
mm-hmm.
maybe it was
yeah.
a guy who just was clueless, and saying, why is it you think that the most successful software companies in the world, the most successful game companies in the world, didn't make their last game with the best of everything in it.
Right.
Why is it you think they made two things really better than everybody else, and the other eight things they did as well as they had to,
mm-hmm.
and then one or two of them they actually kind of fucked up on, but
mm-hmm.
but the everything else was so strong, and a different company succeeded in a different way by taking two different
right,
things
yeah.
and making them great. Why is it you think they didn't just do the smart
do
thing,
the
quote unquote,
yeah.
and make
yeah.
the best of everything? It's like, it's because they're 24 hours in a day,
mm-hmm.
and you have X number of years to make the project,
mm-hmm.
and you can't do everything perfectly, right? So
right.
so anyway, we look at that, and it's I think it's kind of like a measuring process where a group of people, when you try to decide, is it time to start implementing the game, how long is it going to take us? Which of these areas, which of these modules did we decide to do minimally? Which ones did we decide to do according to genre expectations? And which ones did we decide to go
mm-hmm.
further on?
Mm-hmm.
How much work is that? Does this equate to a complete game? Will this game be exciting? We don't know yet. We won't know until we play the prototype.
Mm-hmm.
But then at some point we begin actually making a vertical slice, you know? So if you listed all those things across the board,
mm-hmm.
that's the breadth of the game. That's every single feature has... actually, I just said that wrong, I guess. If you listed all those things in rows from
uh-huh.
top to bottom, so you've got like the lighting model, the mission, the AI, the weapons, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of columns, that's the breadth of the game,
yeah,
right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I guess in terms of rows, that's the breadth of the game. But vertical slice, basically,
mm-hmm.
I hope this part is not verbatim on the recording, by the way, but essentially vertical slice is to list everything that's in the game by column,
mm-hmm.
and then take... or by row, and then take one deep column
mm-hmm.
that cuts through every one of those features. It has a little narrow piece of every one of those features.
Mm-hmm.
So the sample example, or the example would be, you know, while this game might be 20 hours worth of missions with lots of ebb and flow and drama, you know, back and forth, there might be 25 tools that the player uses to influence the environment in some way, from guns to paintbrushes to horses to whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to choose like a handful of those and do one sample canonical kind of environment,
mm-hmm.
and basically look at the play experience at the end of that vertical slice process,
mm-hmm.
and decide in terms of the core features,
mm-hmm.
they're all here. What do we need to add and or subtract? What do we need to tweak and tune?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's more work beyond that. We take the vertical slice and then we move into production, the next phase.
Uh-huh.
And basically, we hand the vertical slice off to a group of people and say, look, this is what the game is at a core, at
mm-hmm.
the core level. Why don't you all, you've worked with us in planning what you would do with this. Well, now I'll take this and, like, replicate it many times over
mm-hmm.
In your own way, and it's variations on the core, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then, at the end of production, you get toward alpha, beta,
mm-hmm.
final.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully during alpha, your game, that means all the features are there. The
mm-hmm.
game is finished, basically. And then you just begin fixing final bugs in beta. And then you begin submitting the game through whatever publishing channel you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft, Sony, Nintendo, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Steam. And some of those are harder and some of those are easier. And then game goes final. And if you're lucky, that last phase, your whole team is not there. Many of them have already rolled off, and
mm-hmm.
you're only just fixing bugs. And you're looking at the game, once the major bugs are fixed, you're looking at the game saying, wow, what's the experience like here? What are our friends and playtesters, what are they saying, and what do we feel like? And if you're lucky, you get a little post-production window
mm-hmm.
before you go final to
mm-hmm.
make final iterations and tuning and...
Mm-hmm.
Can
you play the vertical slice?
Yeah, that's the idea, is it's playable.
So it's not just a scene or something.
No, it's not
a
cinematic.
It's playable, okay.
Very early on during pre-production, we actually do cinematics, recorded video type things.
Okay.
Where we, like, fake the gameplay. It's not playable at all,
right.
You just watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And they teach us a lot, actually. We just did a few of those for the game that we're working on.
Mm-hmm.
They teach you a lot, like, you know, I can't go into details about it, but we just started prototyping this feature.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't started prototyping it yet, technically.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been working on this feature where we talked about it, we did a fake gameplay footage video of it,
mm-hmm.
using gray boxes and gray characters, puppet-looking characters,
mm-hmm.
in Maya,
mm-hmm.
an art package. And then we looked at it, we tweaked it, and we said, oh, you know, it'd be more interesting if right before this happened, the AI had a state that it went into,
mm-hmm.
That gave the player a little window of 2 seconds to act.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's try that. And then we demonstrated what that would look like. And then we documented it, and we made a little spec out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about why we want to do it, and we made the fake gameplay footage. And the next thing is to prototype it and see if it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then it will just be a core feature in the game, and every AI across the game will have this one little state that they
mm-hmm.
that they go into at a certain moment and give you that one little window
mm-hmm.
that you can do something. And
hmm.
So anyway, to recap, I guess it's, you know, pre-production and planning,
mm-hmm.
Vertical slice. You go into production with your full team.
Mm-hmm.
You head toward alpha, beta.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in there, you have time for post-production tuning,
mm-hmm.
and then you go final.
Right.
And every company does it a little differently.
And the prototyping and stuff is in the pre-production phase.
Yeah.
And once you get into the vertical slice point, or you're not really relying on the game design documents anymore.
No,
the game itself becomes
the game.
The
game design document is still in use all through the project, really. It's just that when a feature goes from paper to in the game,
mm-hmm.
the design document becomes almost useless at that point.
Right.
But there are still going to be documents like, while we're moving toward vertical slice, where we have one mission that is like the canonical core experience,
mm-hmm.
we probably have another group in the background planning like the other 20 missions,
mm-hmm.
and detailing them out and doing research on them and coming up with ideas to take the variation of the core experience and make it dramatically dynamic,
mm-hmm.
And meaningful,
mm-hmm.
and novel. And so all that work all the planning work is going on,
mm-hmm.
congruently with the vertical slice, so then when we're ready to roll into production, somebody probably takes that document,
mm-hmm.
it's all the mission plans,
mm-hmm.
and they look at the vertical slice, and then they start using the vertical slice and that mission document to create 20 other missions or whatever.
Right. Okay. So is that essentially the game planning process for all the games that you work on, or are there different processes for different kinds of games?
I'm sure there are variations. I mean, a lot of times I've worked on similar types of games,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes we've screwed up a phase, or we've, you know, one part of it has been shorter, we've been sort of cheated out of it, or we've cheated ourselves out of it, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for the types of games we work on, that's a pretty standard
mm-hmm.
Process. I mean, I just worked on an iPhone game called Karma Star, and even though the team was massively smaller,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes several roles were in one person, that was
mm-hmm.
that's pretty much the same process that we used. The only difference was our vertical slice with Karma Star, our prototype, rather.
Mm-hmm.
Some people don't call it a vertical slice, right? So our prototype
mm-hmm.
was actually a card deck that we made with Uno cards.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a tactical card game, we took Uno cards and wrote on them,
mm-hmm.
and added dice and changed the rules, and we could sit at this table and play the game before
mm-hmm.
we wrote any code.
Right.
And what that meant was we could experiment very rapidly without going back and forth with the engineering,
mm-hmm.
or tweaking any, you know, like recompiling or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
We could just say, hey, on the fly, what if we change this rule so this type of scoring is worth 2 points and not 1 point?
Mm-hmm.
And that was unlike anything I'd ever done before. Like, the closest we had come to that was when we were working on Fireteam. We built some of our maps with Legos,
mm-hmm.
Just to look at them. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, here's a big Lego board. here's where I'd put the obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more like for meetings, not for like a document that you faithfully then went
yeah.
and reproduced.
Mm-hmm.
But for the meetings, if you said, what if you put a barricade right there that everyone could crouch behind, then maybe the team would run up to here and take a defensive position.
Mm-hmm.
And that was useful. But
mm-hmm.
So I think every project probably has some little different
sure.
thing like that in it, but they're all variations of the same thing, I think.
Okay. Do you save, like, these card decks and the... Or did you take pictures of the Lego?
No, generally we're not that interested in documenting things like that because
uh-huh.
they fall out of usefulness at a certain point. But
uh-huh.
but like this is the card deck that we made from the Uno cards for Karma Star. And so there's a point in the game where you get the star. And so we bought these child's glasses with star lenses. But before
mm-hmm.
that, we made a star out of pink sticky
uh-huh.
notes. And we stole the die from some other game. And we took all the yellow cards from Uno and we
mm-hmm.
we made them categories. So they're like
oh,
people,
yeah.
you know, money, mind,
uh-huh. right,
love, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then the blue ones are wild cards. Like you can reshuffle the deck and you score 1 point. Or
I
you
see.
Can
uh-huh.
Pick another player to go twice, you know. So this is like the original deck that we use for playtesting. It'll probably sit on the shelf for a period of time and then somebody will throw it away eventually.
You should give it to the video game archive.
Yeah, I was thinking that we should give it to you so you can give it to him.
You can give it to me. I'll take it
but
and I'll give it to him.
We
They'd
made
love
two
it.
Of those
mm-hmm.
and I think this is the more recent one or something.
You can give me both.
That Walk made.
I'm trustworthy.
This is. I'll give you this from the original
okay.
one. So.
Okay. Yeah.
But anyway, no, we didn't. We didn't take any pictures. I don't know that we had any pictures of the multitude stuff. The Lego. That was Art Min's idea. He was our project director to do that. And, but we have a combination of concept sketches and graph paper maps and occasionally something weird like this, like an Uno deck repurposed.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of whiteboard meetings. Sometimes people take pictures of the whiteboard.
Mm-hmm.
The GDD
mm-hmm.
has sketches in it where we might work something out, like visually, like this, where
uh-huh.
You know, we will say, let's assume that I'm. I don't know. I'm going to pick a bad example here. I'm going to pick a really bad example here. Let's assume that I'm making a game about cats and pigeons in a city. And the cats are trying to hunt me and I'm a pigeon, right? And so this is a rooftop kind of area or
mm-hmm.
something. And or I'm a mouse. A mouse is better.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to go hide in the darkness and try to get the cheese and wait for the cats to go by or whatever.
Uh-huh.
How do we know what system, I mean, how do we know, like, how the cats should behave in terms of search?
Mm-hmm.
Because some games have come out where, like, maybe the cats just know where you're at, and that's
mm-hmm.
no fun. Because
right.
then you're hiding and the cat comes to you and it's
yeah.
boring. Maybe
right.
the cat only knows where you're at if it's within a certain radius. Well, that's no fun either because then you've got, you know, I see that a cat is coming, so I run over to here, which is like an area of darkness, and I'm there. And the cat's just walking along here, and it's oblivious to me. It doesn't know I'm here unless I get within this radius.
Uh-huh.
But it's on a patrol route, and as soon as it gets here, because I'm within its radius, it knows where I'm at, so it runs over and grabs me. That's the way video games were in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
But that's also kind of boring now. And people,
yeah.
the possibility space of games have gone up, and people explore the space more, and they want to play with things in an analog fashion more. So what if, like when, you know, what if, like, the cat instead could... what if it had vision that, like, is a some mathematical combination of distance
mm-hmm.
and whether the architecture of the level was blocking
mm-hmm.
and the light level. What if it was a mathematical algorithm that took all of that into account?
Mm-hmm.
And so then, if it's walking down the hall and I hide here or here, even if I'm outside some radius, it's probably close enough and it's bright enough and it's in its
mm-hmm.
view cone where it sees me and runs over here. But if I hide here and it's dark, then as it goes by, I'm both outside its view cone because I'm hidden on the inside corner
mm-hmm.
and it's dark. And as long as I'm not making sound, it probably goes on. And so what if it hears me?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I then run around here and I knock a box over and it was going this way and it goes, I heard
mm-hmm.
something. So it's going to come. What's it going to do? Is it just going to make a beeline for me because it secretly knows where I'm at? That's going to
right,
players
yeah.
hate that.
Mm-hmm.
It might come search for me. So how do we search? So we might have a system where, like, everywhere I've been, I've left a little marker that, like, you know,
mm-hmm.
this thing will eventually, like, go touch all the markers where I've been. And by this point, I might have, like, hidden
yeah.
somewhere else or whatever. So this system, like, some variation of this like search pattern
mm-hmm.
We will need for our game, and there are many different ways you could do it, and some, like I've said, would be dissatisfying to the player and some
mm-hmm.
would be satisfying. And the GDD is full of systems like modules like searching and detection
mm-hmm.
and it's full of diagrams like that one that somebody generally we'll just take Word, and you, in Word you have that function where you can like draw lines and put shapes down.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody will really quickly recreate that
yeah.
that hallway
mm-hmm.
and put example guards. In example one, the guard is here, or whatever, the cat
mm-hmm.
is here. You
yeah.
know. So,
do you guys save your GDDs and your TDDs?
I think a lot of times they're backed up on the network or something,
mm-hmm.
but
there's no like archiving policy.
Not really. Well, I mean, we are required to back things up and have backup storage, you know, by the,
mm-hmm.
by the publisher, and in case we ever have a data loss.
Right.
And sometimes people keep them. Like, I donated some stuff to the archive
mm-hmm.
that I've been keeping for years, design
mm-hmm.
docs and things
mm-hmm.
like that. But very often, though, you know, one of the games I've worked on that is the best thing I've done so far was the game Deus Ex with
mm-hmm.
War Inspector.
Mm-hmm.
And as a team, we documented the hell out of the game. We probably over-documented the game.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up with a massive design doc, and it was a monolithic document that had details about every mission and every weapon and every scenario in the game,
mm-hmm.
all the systems. But in the end, it became harder and harder to keep the doc up to date
mm-hmm.
because the game was changing so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And on that project, I worked on story stuff, and I worked on game systems, and I worked on level design, environmental
mm-hmm.
mission
mm-hmm.
setup. And, you know, I would go in and make changes to the missions. Like, I would be working in a particular mission, and I would make, like, 20 changes in an hour just by playing through it once and going, oh, that was kind of dissatisfying.
Mm-hmm.
What if I did this and this and this and this and this and moved that chair over there and put an extra guard in here and
mm-hmm.
tagged this guy and put a trigger script in so that when this door opens, he comes to check why, you know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I do things like that, and like none of that is recorded in the document.
Right.
That it would be an insane level of detail if you recorded every single thing like that, you know.
Right.
So the document has to be high level at some level.
Yeah.
And then later you abandon it, you know.
Right. How about for games that just don't end up getting made? At what point? I don't know how to ask this question.
Yeah, so I had...
At what point do you decide not to make a game or not to work on a certain project, and then what happens...
To the documentation.
And what documentation exists at that point.
One of the things I gave to the archive, I'm pretty sure I gave it to them, was this design document for a game I worked on called Technosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the one that got canceled by EA, and there were a lot of firings
mm-hmm.
involved. And but we worked on it for about a year with 13 people, and we had a big binder that had lots of concept art in it. And
mm-hmm.
and it was, you know, 10 years ago or 11 years ago, so I don't... I don't know how mature I would think it was today, because I've learned a lot since then, but,
mm-hmm.
but I was very proud of the type of game we were working on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept that for years, the document.
Mm-hmm.
I think I gave it to the UT archive.
Okay.
Yeah, let me show you something else. There was a... When, there was this game that I just gave you the card deck for.
Uh-huh.
Called Karma Star.
Uh-huh.
That's now out on the App Store, the Apple App Store. There was a day that they made a press release announcement about the App Store coming.
Oh, right. Yeah, you were telling me this.
And that day, I took a bunch of notes, and I think these are from a different thing, but like, these were the notes that I kept for, like, quite a while,
mm-hmm.
before we actually had I had documents that that I could print out that are the rule set,
mm-hmm.
And it went from this,
mm-hmm.
to the rule set document to the card deck, kind of in some,
mm-hmm.
weird messy way, not exactly
right, yeah.
And then went to a code prototype, and then went to the game that
yeah.
you can download on your iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I could print the rule set,
right,
and give you that also, and then you can have this as well. Yeah.
Oh, great. So this is for Karma Star?
Yeah, let me look at it.
Because weren't you saying that it wasn't originally even a card game?
Yeah.
It was originally something
right.
completely different.
And it wasn't originally called Karma Star.
Okay. I just think it's interesting to document, like, the change from, you know, your
yeah.
initial idea to...
I happen to use this as... to write somebody's email address down.
Oh.
I don't even know why I wanted to talk to this person.
I can
black it out or something.
Yeah, I can get a Sharpie.
The business no longer even exists. Yeah, I think initially I had, like, different ideas for names,
mm-hmm.
and I had, like, these phases of play, like birth, childhood, adult,
mm-hmm.
Midlife, senior years, old age, and then death. And then I decided to call it in play instead.
Mm-hmm.
So this was like the very first, and I had like the idea of entity icons that were blue or pink,
mm-hmm.
and that might imply male or female. And I had ideas for interface where you touch something and it would fly out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had ideas for cities. And then, like, the sequence of the play and, the like, what all the traits were that you were trying to up over time,
mm-hmm.
like sex, money,
mm-hmm.
love, family, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the idea that the game would start with no goals, and the players had to pick one of, like, 10 goals to end the game, and everybody
mm-hmm.
might have a different goal.
Mm-hmm.
And then
cool.
I had, like, yeah... like your health, the way you up your health might apply to your longevity.
Mm-hmm.
So some players would drop out of the game earlier than other game players.
Mm-hmm.
It was a game modeled on life, which is a pretty common thing to try to
yeah.
to try to model. But that was day one, like just hearing the announcement and taking notes.
Mm-hmm.
And then this was me reading a book called. Universal Principles of Design, and it's 100 Lessons of Design, not necessarily game design,
mm-hmm.
Like accessibility, and it breaks it down in 2 pages. The 80-20 rule, and it breaks it down in 2 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went through, at one point the game was called Shadow Play or something, and I went through the... lessons
uh-huh.
and thought about it with regard to Karma Star, like
mm-hmm. oh.
how would we apply accessibility, how would we use affordance or alignment,
right, huh. I can have this too.
Yeah, let me read through it just to
okay.
make sure there's nothing crazy in it, but
I'm gonna go to the restroom again.
Okay, yeah,
okay.
Sure. Also, what time is it?
Well, it's probably right at if you need to get going.
Not now, but soon.
Do you usually work at? Am I? Do you usually work here?
Mm-hmm. So you have some days I work at home. Okay. Yeah. Or I go to a coffee shop or something like
that. Yeah, that's good.
Depends on if I want to break the cycle, because if I'm here, people are talking to me constantly, asking questions, or I'm asking them questions. Like even while you were gone, you know, Raph came in and said, "Hey, do we still have the concept in the game of this type of combinable object?" And I was like, "Wow, come to think of it, I guess we don't." You know, so we've eliminated the need for that.
Right.
I said, "There's an exception," and he's like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, but that's done in this other way." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, okay, so we can cut that." And so that's what it's like to work here. You know, it's for anybody who's on the like initial planning cabal for the game, you know, during pre-production, it's just constantly. So if I need to work on something like, you know, we've come up with a structure for player upgrades and we need to like think through all the possible ones we could give you and how that would, how those would interact with other gameplay, like I might do that from home. Or if I'm working on fiction or something, I might do that from home.
Is there any, are there any kinds of documents that you have to send to the publishers?
Yeah, every milestone, we deliver milestone documents. So we just delivered milestone 2, for instance.
So is a milestone related to the phases of production, or...?
Yeah, all the phases of production are broken up into milestones.
Okay.
So the contract might break them up into, like, 20 milestones or 12 milestones or whatever, you know.
And at the end of the milestone, you send them documentation, or you send
Early on, you send them documentation and graphics, and later you send them builds of the game.
Okay.
With accompanying documentation. You
know, right.
Schedules, things like that. You know.
Okay.
Yeah, so our most recent milestone, we like delivered a pitch overview. We delivered some videos that we made of like some types of movement through the world. Some videos that faked AI behavior, so that they could get an idea of what we're talking about, you know. And then at some point down the road, we'll actually deliver a little test room. It won't be pretty. It'll just be a gray box where you can run around in it and interact with the AIs in the way that we faked before.
Right.
And then later, it'll be pretty, and it'll be part of the game. It'll have context because it'll be part of a story mission or something, you know.
Are you about to hire a whole bunch more people? Is that why you made the space bigger?
Yeah, we'll probably grow to 12 people this year here, and we've got 45 in Lyon.
Okay.
One in Montreal.
Okay. And are they going to just, because, are they permanent people?
Yeah.
So they will always be doing something, whether you're working on a big game or a contract or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever contract out artists, or do they always work for you?
We do as much of that as we can, actually, because between our big games, we need to find something for people to do so that they're being paid for, basically, instead of subtracting a company's capital or whatever, you know. And so, like, even this little iPhone game that we made, Karma Star, like, while we were doing business development on the larger game, that paid for me and a couple of other people.
Right.
So we didn't cost the company anything during that time period. Right. And we got better at our jobs because we had the experience of making this small game.
Right.
And hopefully we did something good for the publisher who wanted to release that game.
Okay.
So yeah, we try, you know, unless we're already slammed with a bunch of work or whatever.
You try to keep it all in-house.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, no, we actually contract with other people to do stuff as
well.
Right,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But, and that way we don't have to, like,
that way you
add
20
people to the staff full-time or whatever.
Okay.
You know.
Okay, well, I think that's about it for me. Was there anything you were expecting me to ask you about that I didn't ask you about? Okay.
Not really.
Okay.
I want to mail you a couple of things for Karma Star, though, because that way you've got little snapshots of it all through different phases of development or something, you know, so...
And I'll hand these over to the Video Game Archive.
Okay.
And they might get in touch with you.
Okay.